Hello, everybody. It's Nahani Rouse. Welcome to the fall season of Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive, where gender, history, and Jewish culture meet.
You! Is anybody?
There she is. That's Molly Goldberg, folks, a woman with a place in every heart and a finger in every pie. And now the makers of new Dove.
From 1929 until the mid-1950s, Molly Goldberg was America's favorite Jewish mother. Her character was written, acted, and embodied by Gertrude Berg, the first female showrunner, the first woman to win an Emmy for television, and according to Good Housekeeping, the most popular woman of the era after Eleanor Roosevelt. First on the radio, then in the early days of television, Berg, in character as Molly Goldberg, would begin her show by throwing open the window and leaning out into the air shaft of her apartment building. Wearing a flowered house dress with her dark hair up in a bun, she spoke directly to her TV audience.
Oh, hello. You'll pardon my kimono, yes, please, but I'm getting ready to go out tonight dancing. Can you imagine? Don't forget, I'm not a teenager, but when I'm invited, it's never known.
The Goldbergs debuted on TV in 1949 and ran until the mid-50s, making the working-class Molly Goldberg a household name and Gertrude Berg a millionaire.
You know, Mrs. Herman, it's my neighbor. She always says, how can you feel like going out in the middle of the week after doing the housework all day and cooking and et cetera and et cetera? And believe me, I have plenty et ceteras. First, I was invited, and second, look, here's my answer to your question, Rive, you told. You should only know how much it helps me not to feel tired. That's why I say to you, everybody needs the important elements in Rive, you told, and I know whereof I speak.
With her Yiddish accent and her malapropisms, Molly hawked her sponsor's products, remade the image of the Jewish mother, and snuck lefty politics onto the screen. Meanwhile, her creator, Gertrude Berg, basically invented the family sitcom.
She was an enormously influential, famous, prominent, successful media figure along the lines of like Oprah Winfrey for much of the 20th century.
That's TV critic Emily Nussbaum, staff writer at The New Yorker. She recently wrote about Gertrude Berg for the magazine. In this episode of Can We Talk, Emily Nussbaum introduces us to Gertrude Berg and her lovable character, Molly Goldberg. We talk about what made the Goldbergs so popular, how McCarthy-era persecution led to the show's downfall, and how the show still resonates today. I can't resist. Yoo-hoo, Emily Nussbaum.
Yes.
So why don't we just start by you introducing us to Gertrude Berg?
She was an incredibly scrappy sort of self-created figure. She was born in New York. She grew up in a middle-class Jewish family. She was not actually very much like the character that she played. She didn't grow up speaking Yiddish. She wasn't particularly religious, and she definitely wasn't a hausfrau. She wasn't into cleaning and cooking and anything like that. Her father was the owner of a not super successful Catskills hotel. And the beginning of her career was doing sketches and creating characters at the hotel to entertain the guests. She married very young. And a couple of years into her marriage, right after she had her second child, she made this huge leap. She was in her mid-20s, and she essentially just went out there and sold herself to radio and began writing like a maniac and creating material for herself and trying to go into show business. And she was successful very early, like not too long after she started, she made a big breakthrough, which is that she got this show, The Goldbergs, onto the radio. And that radio show ran from 1929 to 1945.
And now The Goldbergs.
Oh, Rosalie, come kiss Mom. Come kiss Mama, dear. A million times kiss me. Well, dear, on the cheek, on that one, on this one, and come. No, no, darling. Oh, who's happy? Who?
You are mine.
Who's happy?
In this clip, Molly is quelling because her son has just gotten engaged.
Even though it was in certain ways a very, you know, like corny, warm family show, in the landscape of radio, it was unusual for having episodes in which, among other things, she would talk about sort of workers' rights kinds of things, about racial discrimination. And also, they started talking about what was going on with the Jews in Europe, which was not being covered in a lot of places, and certainly not on entertainment shows. So the Goldbergs themselves were talking about, like, our cousins back in Germany. They were talking about the anti-Semitism rising up under Hitler. And this was, like, overtly political material that they were having on the show, and also overtly Jewish material.
The show also explored the struggles many other American families faced in the early 1940s. Here's an episode where Molly is seeing her son off at the train station as he's on his way to fight in World War II.
Okay. Goodbye, Mom.
Bye, son.
All the mothers are weeping on the train platform, and Molly gives a kind of speech to another mother.
Don't cry, madam. Your son? My son, too. This is no time for crying. Today we have to stand like rocks in the sea. We all have to face the same way until our bodies become a wall that lock the fascists in their holes.
The show presented the Goldbergs, an immigrant family whose kids were growing up in America, as deeply patriotic, incredibly all-American. Not as foreigners, not as suspicious, not as outsiders, but as absolutely Yankee Doodle Dandy Americans. That's part of what made the show so effective, so radical in its way. The other parts of the politics I'm describing are kind of more woven in, like little mentions of civil rights issues. And certainly, like, just the focus of the whole show on the lives of workers and the struggles of poor people. And, you know, a lot of the show became successful during the Great Depression. And she got tons of letters saying, thank you for putting on the air just a struggling family, struggling with unemployment, struggling with just trying to survive under these circumstances.
How does the table look, Jay?
Molly, darling, next year this time we'll be eating out of golden plates.
Why, Jake? Will it taste any better?
It will.
Why?
Because my notes will be paid off. The debt on my insurance policy will be paid. I'll be able to rest in my grave if anything happens to me.
Ironically, like, I will say, she became an absolute millionaire during the Great Depression. Like, that was, like, when she cemented her own success and began to live like a fancy New Yorker on Park Avenue. She was really into dressing up. She had a beautiful apartment. But even as she became this very, very wealthy, like, she made more than anyone else in entertainment, she continued on the show to really focus on expressing the lives of working people and the struggles of people during periods of unemployment. And then right at the beginning of television, she repurposed the same material and created really the earliest family sitcom of any kind. TV at that point was a weird experimental new medium. And there's this crazy period right at the beginning from, I would say, like 1947 to 1951, where it was a truly wacky experimental landscape of artists trying to figure out how to use this. Part of what people were trying to figure out was, how will TV work with advertising? Gertrude Berg, working with her sponsors, General Foods, really helped create one of the most effective versions of early integrated advertising on the show. At the beginning of each episode, the camera was facing the window that she had always, on the radio show, she spoke out the window and said, "Yoo-hoo, Mrs. Goldberg, you know, yoo-hoo, Mrs. Bloom," like that. On the TV, you'd be looking at your TV, and the TV outlines would frame the window of her tenement, and Gertrude Berg, in character as Molly Goldberg, would sit in the window near a little potted plant.
The plant was planted in an old Sanka can. That was their sponsor.
Hello. I don't know. Hello is such a little word for such a big feeling. I want to say hello to you with all the letters in the alphabet. That would be a hello. Anyway, hello. How are you? Oh, have I stories for you from Pinker's Pies?
And then she would start speaking to you in your living room as though you were her neighbor.
So that's why I didn't hesitate, the same as I tell you about Sanka. So I told them about Sanka coffee, that it's good for restlessness and it's good for irritability. And then that's why I told them that. And after all, those that didn't know, I told them that 97% of the caffeine is removed and you can drink as much as you want and as often as you want because the sleep is left in. And it comes in regular, comes in instants.
And then when she was finished with it, she'd kind of welcome you. And then she would leave the window and then the camera would be in the living room. Like, who had ever seen such a thing? It was really, really crazy thing to have a TV in your living room. It offered you this different kind of intimacy and kind of felt like a peephole into somebody else's life. And in this case, somebody else's living room.
The Goldbergs debuted on CBS television in 1949. The show was an instant success.
And then the rest of her life, she was the creator of the Goldbergs and also the head of the brand of Molly Goldberg. She was embodied this character who was beloved to much of the American population, both as a kind of idealized mother, as a sort of mischievous, larger-than-life meddler, who was the main character on the show, who gossiped and moved people around, was kind of manipulative but very loving. And also as this very prominent Jewish character, a Jewish mother who was the hero of the show.
Right. Very, very much the center of all of those plot lines.
The center, the main character. So this show was also, for Jews, was this extremely meaningful thing. During a period where there was massive anti-Semitism, this was a character who was a Jewish mother, who was not a comic character, who was not a villain, who was not a minor character, who was the main character.
Molly introduced her audience to a new kind of Jewish mother.
When Gertrude Berg created Molly Goldberg, there were images of Jewish mothers, but they were largely the sort of mournful, guilt-inducing figure of like the Yiddish mama, which is alluded to in songs like My Yiddish Mama and in like the jazz singer, his mother. She's a humble figure who just desperately wants her children to be safe, sometimes to the point of smothering the child. Gertrude Berg, by creating Molly Goldberg, kind of transformed this figure, because instead of being the main character's mother who makes them feel guilty, Molly Goldberg's the main character. Like, Molly Goldberg is the interesting figure. She's the funny one. She's still very involved in her children's lives and pushing them, but that's treated as a comic and positive thing rather than something a little bit anxiety-provoking and dark.
Here's a clip where Molly's son, Sammy, has just come home from college.
My college boy, huh? Looks marvelous.
Yeah, wonderful.
Oh, how many times a person's face changes in one lifetime, huh, darling? Oh, a baby's face, and a little boy's face, and a child's face.
This is something that I've been thinking about since watching these episodes. This is almost 100 years ago, right? And what makes her so alive and believable to us?
Obviously, she wrote thousands and thousands of scripts, but so much of it is in her charisma, like the charisma of her as a performer, her charm, obvious intelligence, and warmth. A lot of it with her was the delivery. She was speaking in this heavy Yiddish accent, and it easily could have been a cartoonish thing, which is just like making fun of an accent. There's a whole tradition of dialect humor, but that's not really how it comes across. It's like the way she uses certain phrases and the way she communicates with her family. It feels very, as you're saying, very authentic, very warm, and very engaging.
And very Jewish. One episode from 1954 takes place on Erev Yom Kippur, when the family is getting ready to go to services. Molly is sitting at the dining room table, painting her nails.
Did Sammy go down for my suit before the tailor closes for the holiday?
Yes. So get finished early shaving and get finished dressing already, so I can also get dressed. I want to be dressed before sundown.
Molly's daughter, Rosalie, finishes her nails for her.
So do me something, yeah, darling. Do my left hand, yeah, dear, and leave the moons out, yeah,
right,
please?
Yes.
So did you decide what you're going to wear tonight, the temple?
Yes.
lot of Jews who were in the radio and later the television business, men who were top executives, were notably wary of putting such blunt Jewish material on TV. It made them uncomfortable for reasons I think a lot of people understand. Like, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. A lot of those guys had internal anti-Semitism and also were wary of attracting negative attention. A lot of people are surprised when I tell them this story because they're like, wait, a woman was this very powerful, super rich showrunner slash producer and also something so bluntly Jewish was. But I think this is true of a lot of cultural periods. Like, there are maybe larger tendencies. Obviously, there was a lot of misogyny and sexism in radio and television. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the country, but there are still representations and exceptional sort of achievements within that. The Goldbergs and Molly Goldberg during, yes, a highly anti-Semitic period, were beloved by Jewish listeners, but definitely by non-Jewish listeners who were really drawn to it as this exotic thing, which was a representation of a Jewish family. It was different than other Jewish humor, which was harsher and more joke-oriented. This was a really Hamish, warm family portrait. And she got tons of letters from non-Jewish listeners saying, you know, I love Molly. They would talk to her as Molly. They would address the letters to Molly. She was one of those celebrities who really embraced the mass audience that she had.
The Yom Kippur episode continues, and in the pre-holiday bustle, Molly has still not finished dressing for synagogue.
Darling, get me my hat. Yes, darling.
Which hat are you going to wear, Molly?
I didn't decide yet which hat. Bring in the hat.
Molly wants some advice about which hat to wear to shul, so she goes to the window and calls to her neighbor across the air shaft.
You, Mrs. Silvertone! You!
Even though they don't use each other's first names, there's an easy intimacy between the women as they lean out their windows, which are just a few feet away from each other.
I just wanted to see what I should wear tonight with my...
Let me see. Which dress are you going to wear it?
With my periwinkle, visualize. Huh?
Maybe a periwinkle, I don't
like it. No. So see this one. See if you like this one better. Let me see.
With a veil, then.
A little better, but
no.
I'm not crazy for it. Me neither. It makes me short and flat.
They end up trading hats over the air shaft.
Here, give me it.
Try mine.
Oh, I always look better than somebody else's hat.
I always told you to take me along when you're going buying a hat.
How is that?
Oh, I love it. Wear it.
So what will you wear?
Come here, let me try yours.
Huh? Try mine.
Here, look.
Let me see.
How do you like this one?
A little bit on the side. Yeah, I love it.
After they trade hats, Molly says to her,
Mrs. Simon, darling, if I did something or said something through the year, I want to say I'm sorry.
And if I said something or did something, I'm sorry.
It's just like, wow, this is like so Jewish.
Yeah, that's so great. The combination of the dressing, the talking across the air shaft, and the Yom Kippur part of it. Yeah, that's really lovely.
The closing scene of the Yom Kippur episode takes place in an ornate synagogue with a full 6-minute rendition of the Kol Nidre prayer, sung by a cantor and men's choir. Molly sits in the women's section, wearing her neighbor's feather-festooned hat.
So one of the plots that I talk about in this essay is one in which they get a new landlord for the building. And the landlord comes in and the building is filled with problems. Like they need to fix the elevator and the staircase. Things are run down. There's a bunch of different problems. And so there's this new landlord that comes in. And this strikes up a huge debate between Molly and her husband. And it is explicitly a political argument that's about strategy, left-wing versus moderate liberal, I would say. So this is a really fascinating thing. Like, this is an episode of television that is a renter's rights debate. How do you deal as a poor person, as a working person, as a renter? And, you know, do you form some kind of a union? This comes from the politics of, I'm sure, Gertrude Berg, but also the politics of Philip Loeb, who played her husband, who was one of the creators of Actors' Equity and was very, very involved in union organizing.
So in the 1950s, McCarthyism struck television and Philip Loeb was blacklisted for some of what you were mentioning, his politics, his support for civil rights and for union organizing.
Yes. What happened is this: the show itself had aligned itself with union approaches to things. So the show actually led a union walkout. There was a technician strike. So they actually walked out. I don't know whether they had blank air go on or something. But then what happened was in June 1950, a publication called Red Channels came out. And Red Channels was essentially just a sort of a little publication that listed names of supposed pinkos, subversives, anybody associated with communism. I mean, communism and being red was this huge umbrella thing that was like anyone who came out for Black civil rights, anyone who supported, like there were numerous things that could mark you as a red in their eyes. And essentially, they just made a list. Red Channels came out, and 2 months later, the network goes to Gertrude Berg and says, you have to fire Philip Loeb. And she said no. And she kind of held them at bay for a long time, but eventually they did simply cancel the show the next June. Now, they claimed, as I will say CBS claimed about Colbert, that this was a financial decision, but that was clearly not true. The show was successful. It was selling Sanka. There's no evidence it was anything but punishment for the politics of it. And the show went off the air in June of 1951. Ultimately, once it went off the air and she tried to jump to a new network, she couldn't get a sponsor unless she dropped Philip Loeb. She accepted this contract with NBC without him, and she ultimately gave him, I would say, a very good deal. And he really needed the money because he had a mentally ill, sick child who was institutionalized and he was broke. He became deeply, deeply depressed. And ultimately, he checked into a hotel and took an overdose and he committed suicide. They hired a new actor to play Jake on the air. But his suicide, understandably, cast a real shadow over the legacy of the show. Bit by bit, that show got worse in many ways. I mean, it's not that it got less skilled as a sitcom, but it definitely got less Jewish, certainly less political. The sponsors and the networks insisted they move the Goldbergs from the city to the country. So they ended up moving out to Connecticut, where, you know, there was no window that you could yell out to your neighbors in the same way. And I think the character of Molly Goldberg changed over time. Molly became more self-abnegating and neurotic, and like the dynamics of the show changed. I mean, it's not that there's nothing funny on it, but it does become, to me, a little more misogynist. There's an episode where she goes to a fat farm. Like, Gertrude Berg was very heavy. It's a part of the character that she was fat, but it was never an aspect of the show. Like, she was a confident character, confident in her body and an affectionate relationship with her husband. There's just a tonal change. And definitely the Jewishness was so sanded down and watered down and eliminated that it's a little shocking to watch some of the later episodes. By the end of the Goldbergs, I think most people agree it was kind of limping as a show.
The last new episode of the Goldbergs ran in 1954, and nothing Berg did afterwards quite matched Molly Goldberg's star power.
I mean, toward the end of her life, Gertrude Berg, very, very, very hard worker, talented performer, did have a few other little breakthroughs. She starred in a Broadway show called A Majority of One. She won the Tony Award for that role. So she did do some other stuff. But I will say, when she published her memoir 4 years before her death, she didn't mention anything about the blacklist. She has one line about Philip Loeb. The whole thing was, I think, shameful and sad, and people didn't want to discuss. And part of what I write about in that essay is how much of this reflects on what's going on nowadays, right? Like, There's the blacklist and the situation in which institutions, networks, universities, law firms just drop what are theoretically their values in order to knuckle under to powerful forces telling them to shut up or to get rid of controversial people. Obviously, that's not just something that happened in the early 50s. Something that happens now too. So I think it's a, you know, worthwhile thing to look back on those blacklist years for certain lessons about how human beings act.
And what lessons do we take away from the story that are applicable to today?
There's a part of this story that I think is really positive. I think it's important to reclaim the legacy of someone like Gertrude Berg, a fascinating, iconoclastic, hugely productive, wildly creative, deeply influential person who's been largely forgotten and who I think should be celebrated. And there's another part of the story where it is an undeniably sad and complicated story about cowardice. I'm not saying on the part of Berg, I'm saying, you know, during the entire period, the feeling of terror people felt. And also it's very much about the way that progress, including cultural progress, including issues of representation, don't always just move forward. They sometimes move forward and then swing back. And that's very much what happened, I feel like, with this show. I mean, not all of this is about the blacklist. Some of this is about sexism. Some of this is about Jewishness. Some of this is about representations of Jewish mothers, which, you know, as I think many people know, by the 60s, the Jewish mother, you know, Gertrude Berg played a hero. The Jewish mother became like a national joke and a villain in you know, Woody Allen or Philip Roth books. And so I see Molly Goldberg as this towering figure who transformed the role into like the central character, and then she's demoted and put on the side again. And honestly, in the decades that passed, there's been a lot of improvements in this, but I think a lot of us grew up knowing the Jewish mother as kind of a like a comic trope, an embarrassment. And I think it's great to reclaim the version of it that comes through Molly Goldberg, which is somebody that you can love, identify with, and see as sort of heroic.
Dear friend, let me just wish for all of you God's blessings on this day and greetings from our family to your family. Good night.
Gertrude Berg died in 1966, just before her 67th birthday. You can watch episodes of The Goldbergs online today on YouTube and Amazon, thanks to digitized kinescope recordings, which were created by filming a television screen. Emily Nussbaum shared Berg's story for this episode. Emily is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her recent article about Gertrude Berg is called The Forgotten Inventor of the Sitcom. Thank you for joining us for Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive. Our team includes Jen Richler and Judith Rosenbaum. You can find us online at jwa.org/canwetalk or anywhere you get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Nahani Rouse.